I will take you to the handlers. She saw that the other three half-human creatures had been standing still, their muscles coiled to pounce if she had given the wrong answer. Their eyes glowed yellow with an inner hunger and a desperate need. The planet of the handlers. If the Bene Gesserits hoped to make a good impression on the inhabitants below, returning four lost futars might gain them leverage. And it would be good for her to bring them back where they belonged. Shiana promised, Herm said. Shiana friend. Shiana not bad lady honored Matre. Smiling, she stroked the creature again. You four will accompany me. Even a great tower has its weak point. The accomplished warrior finds and exploits the smallest flaws to bring about complete ruin. Matre Superior Helica, Internal Directive 67B-1138. Now that Matre Superior Helica had provided the services of her pet lost Tliloxu researcher, Edric was confident that Uxtal could recreate one of the old masters who knew how to manufacture spice. Had not the Oracle herself told him there was a solution? But now the Matre Superior demanded something in return. If he meant to have his manufactured spice, Edric could not refuse. Reluctantly, the navigator accepted the task, knowing full well the consequences he risked. The witch Mirbella would be furious, which was only part of the reason he took pleasure in what they were about to do. 5 years ago, brash honored Matres from Gamu had tried to launch their last few obliterators against Chapter House itself. But that had been a flawed plan from the start. Even the navigator aboard that highliner had been unaware of the scope of the threat. By attacking Chapter House, the honored Matres had meant to wipe out the only remaining source of melange. Idiocy. The foolish whores had failed, and Mother Commander Mirbella had seized their obliterators. Shortly afterward, she had crushed the honored Matres on Gamu and destroyed their entire enclave. This time, though, the objective was different, and Edric had no qualms about helping Helica punish Mirbella and her greedy witches. The Bene Gesserit would feel the sting, and a billion people would die on Richesi in a matter of moments. Edric did not feel guilty, however. The Spacing Guild had not provoked this crisis. Therefore, the blood would be on Mirbella's hands. The new sisterhood's draconian spice policies had done little to ensure loyalty or cooperation from the navigators. The guild paid exorbitant prices for black market melange squeezed out of ancient stockpiles, while the administrator faction happily sought alternative guidance systems that would also make the navigators obsolete. Edric had been forced to seek an alternative source, relying on the memories locked inside the golas of Tliloxu Master Waff. Once those memories were awakened, the navigators would have their own cheap and secure source of melange. His highliner winked into existence above the industrialized planet. For millennia, Richesi had been a sophisticated technological hub. The new sisterhood had poured fortunes into Richesi, and over the past several years, the shipyards had grown larger than any of the famed guild facilities on Junction or elsewhere. The most extensive the human race had ever put together. The Sisterhood claimed their newly manufactured weapons were to be used against the outside enemy. Without question, however, Mirbella would first turn that might against the honored Matres on Tlilox. Destroy it, said Matre Superior Helica from her observation lounge below the navigator's deck. Destroy it all. From spaceport complexes below and satellite stations, monitors pinged them with inquiries and communication bursts. Though Richesi was a huge manufacturer of armaments, engaged in full-scale preparations for the coming battles, they'd never had any reason to suspect a threat from the Spacing Guild. Guild Highliner, we were not aware of a scheduled arrival. Please transmit your manifests. Which docking centers will you utilize? Highliners, we will prepare our outgoing shipments. Is a Chome representative aboard? Edric did not answer. The Matre Superior issued no ultimatum, delivered no warning. She did not even open the channel so that she could gloat. Guildsmen followed the detailed preparations for deploying the last few obliterators the rebel honored Matres had kept on Tlilox. Floating in his sealed tank, Edric smiled. This would set back the new sisterhood's military plans by years, if not decades. All those weapons gone, as well as the industrial capability to manufacture more. In a single strike, Matre Superior Helica would remove a keystone from the arch of human civilization. I do it for spice, Edric thought. The Oracle promised us a new source of melange. Hatches opened in the Highliner's belly, disgorging obliterators that dropped toward the planet like molten cannonballs. Reaching the appropriate atmospheric depths, the weapons fissioned and spread ripples of hot annihilation. The people of Richesi could not conceive of what was happening as their whole planet began to catch fire. Cracks raced across the continents, and flame fronts roared through the atmosphere. The electromagnetic bands were full of desperate cries, screams of terror and pain, and then piercing EMP feedback as the obliterators completed their work. Across the planet, weapons shops, construction yards, cities, mountain ranges, and whole oceans vanished into ionized vapor. The ground itself turned to a blistering, baking ceramic. Even Edric was awed by what he saw. He hoped that Helica understood what she was doing. This was an aggression Mother Commander Mirbella could never ignore, and she would know whom to blame. Tlilox was the only rebel-honored Matre enclave left. In silence, the Highliner departed, leaving the now-dead Richesi behind. Rot at the core always spreads outward. Sufi proverb. There is a time for violence and for talking. This is not the time for talking. Mirbella had called both Janess and the former honored Matre Kyria to stand beside her in the highest tower of the keep. After the annihilation of Richesi, her anger grew hot enough to sear even the voices in other memory. We need to cut the head off the monster. So many vital weapons had been destroyed there. A gigantic and fully armed fleet nearly completed, so much potential for the defense of humanity, all ruined by the bitch Queen Helica. Aside from the armament shipments they had already received, Mirbella had nothing but cooling slag to show for her years of payments to Richesi. It was an overcast morning on Chapter House, with clouds that owed more to dust storms than to rain. A cold front had swept in. Such were the vagaries of climate in the ecosystem's death throes. On the practice field far below, the Valkyries wore heavy hooded black robes and gloves against the biting wind, though Reverend Mothers could manipulate their metabolism to endure temperature extremes. Their furious mock combat engagements were breathtaking as they abandoned themselves to violence. They had all heard the news of the destruction of Richesi. Tlilox is our last and only target, Korea said. We should move without delay. Strike now and without mercy. Janess was more cautious. We cannot afford anything but total victory. That is their most powerful remaining stronghold, where the whores are most entrenched. Mirbella's expression turned cagey. That is why we will employ a different tactic. I need the two of you to open the way. But we will strike Tlilox. Korea was fixated on the idea. No. We will conquer it. The bitter breeze increased in intensity. I will kill Matre Superior Helica myself, and the Valkyries will eradicate the rest of the rebel whores, once and for all. Mirbella wanted to bravely reassure them that the new sisterhood would get other weapons, other ships. But from where? And how would they pay for such a massive expenditure when they were already nearly bankrupt? Their credit extended beyond any realistic ability to repay. The necessary steps were clear to her. Increase spice harvesting efforts in the Chapter House Desert Band and offer more spice to the Ravenous Guild, which should convince them to cooperate with the Sisterhood's much larger plan to defend humanity. If she fed their insatiable hunger for melange, the guild would be happy to help her mount an effective military operation. A small enough price to pay. What is your plan, Mother Commander? Janess asked. She turned to her grim-faced daughter and the brash Korea. You two will take a team down to Tlilox in secret. Dress as honored matres and move among them, exposing their weaknesses. I give you 3 weeks to find ways to bring down our enemies from within their own ranks, and then to implement the scheme. Be ready in time for my full-scale assault. You want me to pretend to be one of the whores? Janess asked. Korea sniffed. It will be simple for us. No honored matre could control herself well enough to walk undetected among us. But the converse is not true. She flashed a feral grin at Janess. I can show you how. The other young woman was already grasping the possibilities. By moving secretly among them, we can plant explosives in key strongholds, sabotage their defenses, and transmit encoded plans with all the details of how well entrenched they are in Bandalong. We can cause chaos and disruption at a critical moment. Korea cut her off. We will open the way for you, Mother Commander. She flexed her claw-like fingers, anxious to let herself become bloodthirsty again. I look forward to it. Mirbella stared into the distance. After Tlilox was secured, the new sisterhood, the Spacing Guild, and all other allies of humanity could face the real enemy. If we are to be destroyed, let it be at the hands of our true foe, rather than from a knife in the back. Send for a guild representative immediately. I have a proposal to make. The scattering spread us far from the reach of any single threat. It also changed us, making our genetic lines diverge so that never again would human mean only one thing. Mother Superior Alma Mavis Taraza, request for analysis and modification of Bene Gesserit breeding program. Teg circled the no-ship's lighter over a forested area near one of the unusual native settlements. Shiana noted a park-like city with cylindrical towers interspersed through thick trees, camouflaged to blend in with the forest landscape. The handlers, if that was who they truly were, distributed their settlements evenly throughout the wooded zones. The people seemed to prefer open spaces to life in a dense, hive-like metropolis. Maybe the scattering had quenched any desire for crowding. Though he'd had little opportunity to practice flying, the Bashar obviously remembered his skills from his first life. When they touched down in a flower-spangled meadow, Shiana barely felt a bump. Young Thufir Hawat sat in the co-pilot seat, observing everything his mentor did. The forest city's main buildings were tall cylinders, several stories high, made of golden lacquered lumber like wooden organ pipes for a wilderness cathedral. Guard towers? Defensive structures? Or were these nothing more than observation platforms from which to gain an unblocked view of the serene and rolling woods? All around them, the thick forest of silver-barked aspen derivatives was beautiful and healthy, as if the natives tended it with loving care. Previously, using the curt descriptions the futars could give her, Shiana had done her best to make the no-ship's arboretum reminiscent of the home they remembered. As she looked at the sweeping aspen analogs around them, however, Shiana saw that she had failed miserably. Secure in the cargo chamber at the back of the lighter, the four anxious futars rumbled and yowled as if they sensed they were home and knew the handlers were near. When the vessel's side hatch opened and the boarding ramp extended, Shiana stepped forward first. Teg and Thufir joined her on the soft grass while the rabbi hung back in the shelter of the lighter's door. She drew a breath of bitingly clean air laden with a resinous scent of wood pulp and old leaves, scattered sawdust, and rain. Tiny yellow and white flowers added perfume to the air. The endlessly recycled air aboard the Ithaca had never smelled so good, nor had the dry air of Rakkas, where Shiana had been a child, nor even Chapter House. Not far away, Shiana saw figures atop the towers. Other silhouettes appeared behind small windows cut through the lacquered mosaic of flat boards. Lookouts signaled from the flat, circular roofs. Horns blew with a vibrating blat while strobing light signals flashed to more distant receivers. Everything looked bucolic, natural, and refreshingly primitive. When a delegation finally came forward, Shiana and her companions got their first look at the supposed handlers. As a race, the people were tall and thin, with narrow shoulders and elongated heads. Their long limbs were loose and bent easily at the joints. The leader was a comparatively handsome man with bristly silver-white hair. Most striking was the dark band of pigment that ran across his pale face and around his green eyes, like a bandit's mask. All of the natives, males and females, had the same raccoon-like pigmentation, which did not appear to be artificial. As the group's spokesperson, Shiana stepped forward. Before she could say a word, she noted an instant spark of suspicion as the natives focused on her, assessing, condemning. Ignoring the rabbi, the Bashar, and Thufir Hawat, they directed their sharp gazes at her. Only her. She became instantly alert, her mind racing. What had she done wrong? Then, when Shiana considered their ambassadorial party, an old man, a young man, and a boy, all of whom accompanied a strong woman who clearly assumed command, she suddenly realized her foolishness. Handlers had bred futars to hunt down and kill honored matres. Therefore, they must consider the whores their mortal enemies. And when they saw her supposedly in charge of these men, "I am not an honored matre," she blurted before they could draw an erroneous conclusion. "And these males are not my slaves. We have all fought the honored matres, and now we flee them." The rabbi reacted with surprise, frowning at Shiana as if he couldn't understand what she was talking about. "Of course you're not an honored matre," He had not noticed the undercurrent of suspicion. Teg, though, nodded with quick understanding. We should have known better. Thufir Hawat also sorted through the information, reaching the same conclusion. The tallest man with the raccoon eyes considered her words for a moment, glanced at the three men with Shiana, and then bowed his elongated head. His voice was quiet but resonant, as if it emerged from deep in his chest instead of his throat. Then we share the same enemies. I am Orak Tho, this district's chief handler.
Handlers? It is true, then.
Shiana felt a rush of excitement and relief. Orak Tho leaned forward, uncomfortably close to Shiana. Instead of extending his hand in a more traditional greeting, he drew in a long, loud sniff at the base of her neck. He straightened in surprise.
You have futars with you.
I smell them on your skin and clothing.
Four of them, rescued from the honored Matres. They asked us to bring them here.
Teg whispered something to Thufir, and the young man obediently hurried back to the lighter. Showing no fear, he released the four beast men from the secure compartment. The futars bounded free, surging happily past the young man with Herm in the lead. Taking graceful leaps, he sprang across the soft meadow grass toward the chief handler and his companions.
Home. Herm purred in his throat.
Orak Tho bent his streamlined face closer to Herm's. The handler's movements also had a hint of the animal about them. Maybe such mannerisms helped the handler's bond with the futars, or maybe these two codependent branches of humanity were not so far apart after all. The freed futars milled among the handlers, who touched and sniffed them excitedly. Shiana smelled the heavy, musky odor of pheromones, released either for communication or control.
Herm broke away just long enough to turn back toward Shiana.
In the glow of his yellow predator's eyes, she could read immense gratitude.
Egola's memories can be a treasure trove or a crouching demon waiting to strike. Never unlock Egola's past without first taking precautions to protect yourself. Reverend Mother Shuangyu, report from Gamu Keep.
After 3 years of unsuccessful attempts and different torture techniques to awaken his memories, Vladimir began to fear that Krohn might be losing interest, or losing hope. Trapped in a rut of ineffective methods, the face dancer simply didn't know what he was doing. Even so, the 15-year-old Gola had come to look forward to their little sessions of suffering. Having figured out that Krohn would never really hurt him, he had come to revel in the pain. Today, when the face dancer guards told the Gola to lie back on a different table, he didn't bother to suppress his broad grin. Such smiles seemed to make them quite uncomfortable. Vladimir had no real interest in cooperating just for the sake of pleasing Krohn, but he was very curious to access the thoughts of the historical Baron Harkonnen. He was sure those memories would be full of excellent ideas for amusing himself. Unfortunately, the fact that he wanted to have his memories back and the perverse pleasure he derived from the pain inflicted upon him turned out to be a hindrance. While waiting, he looked around the stone-walled dungeon chamber of the restored castle, envisioning what it might have been like here in ancient times. The Atreides had probably made it sunny and bright, but he wondered if some long-forgotten duke had used this very chamber to torture captive Harkonnens. Yes, Vladimir could imagine what such devices might have been like. Electronic probes that could be inserted into living bodies, tunneling instruments that could seek and destroy specific organs. Archaic, old-fashioned, and effective. When Crone entered the chamber, his normally placid face showed tiny marks of tension around the mouth and eyes. In our last session, you were very nearly terminated. Too much cerebral stress. I shall have to gauge your limits better. Oh, how awful that must have been for you, the 15-year-old said sarcastically and gave an exaggerated sigh. If restoring my memories requires so much pain that it kills me, then all your hard work will be for nothing. What to do? What to do? The face dancer leaned close. You will see soon enough. Vladimir heard the sounds of machinery, the noise of something clattering and rolling into the room. It came toward the top of his head, but remained out of his range of vision. The anticipation and ominous fear felt delicious. What would Crone do differently this time? The unseen machine sounded like it was directly behind him now, but it did not stop. Vladimir turned his head from side to side and saw a thick-walled cylindrical chamber sliding slowly forward, beginning to engulf him, starting with his feet and legs, as if he were being swallowed by a whale. The cylinder was like a large pipe or a medical diagnostic unit. Or a coffin. Vladimir felt a thrill of pleasure as he guessed what this machine must be. A whole-body agony box. The face dancers must have built it specially for him to create a more intimate experience. The young man grinned, but asked no questions, for fear of spoiling any surprises the face dancers might have in store for him. From outside, Crone watched him with an unreadable expression as the table slid entirely into the chamber. The ugly patchwork observers were also there, but no one spoke. The machine's end cap snapped shut and sealed with a hiss. Vladimir's ears popped as the pressure changed. Crone's voice came over a tinny-sounding speaker system. You are about to experience a variation on the processes used by old Tliloxu masters to develop their twisted mentats.
Ah, I had a twisted mentat once.
Vladimir laughed with genuine fearlessness.
Are you going to talk about the device or use it?
The illumination shut off inside the cylinder, plunging him into complete blackness. Indeed, something different.
Do you think I'm afraid of the dark? He shouted, but the walls of the cylinder were coated with a sound-absorbing substance that swallowed even the whisper of an echo.
He couldn't see anything. Surrounded by a faint hum, he felt himself growing weightless. The table dropped away beneath him, and he could no longer feel it against his back. Cradled in a suspensor field that held him perfectly balanced and immobile, he could no longer feel anything or see anything. The temperature was perfect inside the chamber, imparting no sensation of heat or cold. Even the faint humming stopped, leaving him in a silence so absolute that he could hear nothing but a slight ringing in his ears, and even that faded.
This is boring. When is it going to start?
The darkness remained, and silence, its companion as well. He felt nothing and could not move. Vladimir made a rude noise.
This is ridiculous.
Crone clearly did not grasp the nuances of sadism.
You play with my body to get to my mind, and play with my mind to get to my body. Twisting, contorting. Is that all you have?
10 minutes later. Or was it an hour? He still had no answer.
Crone?
Nothing happened. He remained perfectly comfortable, detached from all sensation.
I am ready. Do your worst.
Crone didn't answer. No pain came. Nothing. They must be trying to drive his anticipation to a fever pitch. He licked his lips. It would start any second now. Crone left him there in dark, weightless isolation for an eternity. Vladimir tried to clutch at memories of previous sensations, but they kept slipping away, fading from his mind. Struggling to retrieve the thoughts, he followed a mental pathway and felt himself carried on a neural conduit deep into his own brain, a realm of total darkness. The experiences he sought were pinpoints of light ahead, and he swam toward them. But they swam away faster and farther than he could reach. Another eternity passed. Hours? Days? He could feel nothing, absolutely nothing. Vladimir didn't want to be here. He wanted to swim back out to the light that was his Gola life before this session had begun. But he couldn't. It was a trap. Eventually, he screamed. At first, it was just to make noise, to disturb the throbbing emptiness. Then he screamed for real, and once he started, he could not stop himself. Even so, the silence remained. He thrashed and struggled, but the field kept him immobile. He couldn't breathe. He couldn't hear. Had the face dancers blinded him somehow? Made him deaf? Vladimir wet himself, and for a few moments the mere sensation was a revelation, but it quickly faded, and he was left alone in empty, silent darkness. He needed sensation, stimulus, pain, interaction, pleasure, anything. Finally, he became aware of a gradual change around him. Non-existent illumination, sounds and smells seeped in, gradually filling the Stygian universe, converting it to something else. Even the tiniest glimmer was like an explosion. With that catalyst, senses poured into his conscious and unconscious mind, filling every cavity. Pain. A mental pain made his head feel as if it would explode. He screamed again. This time, the pain brought no semblance of pleasure whatsoever. The full life of the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen flooded back into the Gola body with all the subtlety of an avalanche. Every thought and experience came back to him, all the way up to the moment of his first death on Arrakis. He saw the little girl Aaliyah stabbing him with the poisoned needle, the Gom Jabbar. The internal universe expanded, and he became aware of voices again. He was outside the chamber now, withdrawn from the large coffin-like device. The Baron sat up indignantly, pleased and surprised to note his younger body, which was a bit plump from overindulgence, but not ravaged by the bloating and debilitating disease the witch Mohayim had inflicted upon him. He looked down at himself, grinned up at the face dancers.
Oh, the first thing I want is a better wardrobe. And then I want to see that Atreides brat you've been raising for me.
Crone stepped closer, his expression inquisitive.
You have access to all of your memories, Baron.
Of course. Baron Harkonnen is indeed back. He wandered into his thoughts, reassured by the things he had achieved in his original glorious lifetime. He was delighted to be himself again. But deep inside his brain, lurking at the back of his mind, he sensed that something was wrong, out of his control. An unwanted presence had joined him inside his mind, hitchhiking on his memories.
"Hello, Grandfather," a girl's voice said. She giggled.
The Baron's head jerked. Where was that coming from? He didn't see her.
"Did you miss me, Grandfather?"
"Where are you?"
"Where you won't lose me. I will always be with you now. Just like you were with me, haunting me, appearing in visions, refusing to give me rest."
The girl's giggle became more shrill.
"Now, it's my turn."
It was the abomination, Paul's sister.
"Aaliyah? No, no."
His mind must be playing tricks on him. He dug his fingers against his temple, but the voice was inside, unreachable.
With time, she would go away.
"Don't count on it, Grandfather. I am here to stay."
Each civilization, no matter how altruistic it purports to be, has its means of interrogating and torturing prisoners, as well as an elaborate system to justify such actions. From a Bene Gesserit report. Though he was genetically identical to the other 7 Golas in the first batch, Waff number 1 did not like being so short, small, and weak. His accelerated body had reached its mature size in less than 4 years, but he wanted to be strong enough to escape this maddening confinement. As he peered out through the shimmering confinement field, Waff seethed at Uxtal and the laboratory assistants. His 7 counterparts did the same. The lost Tliloxu researcher was like a nervous prison guard, constantly prodding and herding the 8 matching Golas. All of the Waffs loathed him. He imagined sinking his teeth into Uxtal's neck and feeling the hot blood surge into his mouth. The researcher and his assistants were too cautious now, though. The Gola brothers shouldn't have made their earlier attack on him before they were ready to succeed. That had been a tactical mistake. A year ago, they had been so much younger. Standing safely on the other side of the confinement field, Uxtal frequently lectured the 8 Golas about his great belief, implying that all the original Tliloxu people had been criminals, heretics. Yet all of the Waffs could tell that he wanted something from them. Very badly. They were smart enough to realize they were pawns. The withered, honored Matre Ingva often talked with Uxtal about Melange, as if she didn't think or care that the Waffs could hear her. She demanded to know when the children would reveal their secrets. Waff wasn't aware that he had any secrets. He didn't remember any.
"They mirror and mimic each other," Uxtal said to Ingva. "I have heard them speak simultaneously and make the same noises, the same motions. The other Gola groups are growing even faster, it seems."
"When can we get started?"
Ingva hovered close to him, making the little researcher squirm. "I am not reluctant to threaten you or tempt you with a sexual experience beyond your most incredible fantasies." Uxtal seemed to shrink into himself and answered in a voice that cracked with fear.
Yes. Those eight are as ready as they are ever going to be. No sense in waiting any longer.
They are expendable, said Ingvar.
Not exactly expendable. The next batch is 6 months younger, and the others are even more recently removed from the tanks. 24 in all, of varying ages. Even so, if we are forced to kill all eight of these, there will be others soon. We can try again and again and again.
He swallowed hard.
We have to expect a certain number of mistakes.
No, we don't. Ingvar released the force field and licked her lips.
She and Uxtal entered the protected chamber while the lab assistants stood guard outside. The eight Golas clumped together, backing away. Until now, they had not known that numerous other WAF Golas were being raised elsewhere in the large laboratory building.
Uxtal gave the accelerated Gola children a forced smile of encouragement, which none of the WAFs believed.
Come with us.
There's something we have to show you.
And if we refuse? Demanded WAF 3.
Ingvar chuckled. Then we will drag you. Unconscious, if necessary.
Uxtal wheedled. You will learn why you are here, why we made you, and what you have that we need.
WAF 1 hesitated, looked at his identical brothers. It was a temptation they could not resist. Though they had received forced educational induction, given inexplicable background to lay a foundation for something, the Golas were hungry to understand.
I will go,
WAF 1 said, and he actually took Uxtal's hand, pretending to be a sweet child. The nervous researcher flinched at the touch, but led the way out of the protected chamber. WAFs 2 through 8 followed. They entered a confined laboratory where Uxtal paraded the Golas in front of a spectacle. Several brain-dead Tliloxu masters hooked up to tubes and instruments. Drool curled down gray chins. Machines covered their genitalia, pumping, milking, filling translucent bottles. The victims all looked uncomfortably like WAF, only older. Uxtal waited while the staring children absorbed what they saw.
You used to be that. All of you.
WAF 1 raised his pointed chin with some measure of pride.
We were Tliloxu masters?
And now you must remember what you were. Along with everything else.
Line them up, Ingvar ordered.
Uxtal handed the WAF roughly to an assistant and waited until all of the accelerated children stood in front of him. Strutting back and forth in front of the identical copies like a caricature of a commander, Uxtal made explanations and demands. The old Tliloxu masters knew how to manufacture melange using axolotl tanks.
You have that secret. It is buried within you.
He paused, clasped his small hands behind his back.
We don't have our memories, one of the WAFs said.
Then find them. If you remember, we will let you live.
And if we don't?
WAF 1 asked defiantly.
We have 8 of you here, and others elsewhere. We need only 1.
The rest of you are completely disposable. Ingvar chuckled. And if all 8 of you fail us, then we will simply turn to the next 8 and repeat the process. As many times as necessary.
Uxtal tried to look intimidating.
Now, which of you will reveal what we need to know?
The matching Golas stood in the line. Some fidgeted, some remained defiant. It was a standard Gola awakening technique to drive a person to psychological and physical crisis, forcing the buried chemical memories to overcome the barriers inside.
"I don't remember," the WAFs all said in perfect unison.
A commotion interrupted them, and Uxtal turned as Matre Superior Helica, resplendent in a purple bodysuit and flowing veils and capes, strode into the chamber leading a small guild delegation and a floating, hissing chamber that held a mutated navigator. Edric himself.
"We came to watch the completion of your task, little man, and to reach financially acceptable terms with the navigators, should you succeed."
Surrounded by plumes of cinnamony orange gas, Edric approached a viewing window in his tank. The 8 Golas felt the tension in the chamber increase. Uxtal gathered enough courage to yell at the WAFs, though he seemed almost comical doing so.
"Tell us how to make spice in the axolotl tanks. Speak if you want to live."
The WAFs understood the threat and believed it, but they had no memories to reveal, no stored knowledge. Sweat blossomed on their small gray foreheads.
"You are Tliloxu Master Tilwith WAF. All of you. You are everything he was. Before he died on Rakkas, he prepared replacement Golas of himself here on Tlilox. We used cells from those."
He jerked his head toward the miserable, mindless men on their extraction tables.
"To create the 8 of you. You hold his memories stored in your minds."
"Obviously, they require more incentive," Matre Superior Helica said, looking bored.
"Ingva, kill one of them. I don't care which."
Like a murderous machine, the old honored Matre had been waiting to be activated. She could have attacked with a traditional flurry of kicks and blows, but she had come prepared for something more colorful. She drew a long slaughtering knife she had confiscated from the neighboring slig farmer. With a sideways sweep of the mono blade and a quick flash of blood, Ingva decapitated WAF 4 in the middle of the line. As the head hit the floor, WAF 1 cried out in sympathetic pain, along with his surviving brothers. The head rolled to a stop at an odd angle, to stare with glazing eyes at the blood pooling out from the neck stump. The Golas all tried to run like panicked mice, but were brutally restrained by the assistants. Uxtal turned greenish, as if he might either faint or vomit.
"The memories are triggered through psychological crisis, Matre Superior. Simply butchering one of them is not sufficient. It must be prolonged, an extended anguish, a mental dilemma."
Helica nudged the bloody head with her toe. "The torture wasn't intended for this one, little man, but for the 7 others. It's a basic rule. If one inflicts only pain, the subject can cling to hope that the torture will end, that he may somehow survive." A thin smile robbed the Matre Superior's face of all beauty. "Now, however, the others have not the slightest doubt that they will be killed if I say they are to be killed. No bluffing. That certainty of death should provide the correct trigger, or they will all die. Now, proceed." Ingva left the small body lying there.
7 of you remain," Uxtal said, reaching a crisis point of his own. "Which of you will remember first?"
"We don't know the information you request,"
WAF 6 shouted.
"That is unfortunate.
Try harder."
As Helica and the navigator watched, Uxtal signaled Ingva. The woman took her time choosing, drawing out the tension, walking slowly up and down the ranks of the young Golas. The wafts trembled and then shook as she prowled behind them.
"I don't remember,"
Waff 3 wailed. Ingva responded by thrusting the point of her bloody slaughtering knife into his back and out his chest, piercing his heart on the way through.
"Then you are of no use to us."
Waff 1 felt a sharp pain strike his own heart, as if an echo of the blade had stabbed there too. The clamor in his mind reached a crescendo. He no longer had any thought of defiance or of withholding information. He did not resist the memories or past lives inside him. He squeezed his eyes shut and screamed silently to himself, begging his body to divulge what it knew. But nothing came to him. Ingva lifted her long blade, jerking the Waff 3 Gola into the air with it, his legs still kicking. Then she let him slide off the tip, and he thudded to the floor. Ingva stepped back, waiting to be called again. She was clearly enjoying this.
"You make this more difficult than it needs to be," Uxtal said. "The rest of you can stay alive. All you have to do is remember. Or does death mean nothing to a Gola?"
With a disappointed sigh, he nodded again, and Ingva killed another one.
5 left.
He looked down at the unpleasant mess, then glanced apologetically to Helica.
"There is a possibility that none of these Golas is acceptable. The next batch will be ready soon, but perhaps we should prepare more axolotl tanks, just in case."
"We're trying," one of the Waffs cried.
"You are also dying.
Time is running out." Uxtal waited for a moment until his anticipation turned to clear dismay. He was sweating too. His entire career, such as it was hanging on the line. Ingva killed another one. Half of the Waffs now lay dead on the floor. Moments later, she killed a fifth, stepping up behind him, grabbing his dark hair and slitting his throat. Frantic, the remaining 3 Waffs tore at their own hair and struck themselves in the chests and faces, as if physical blows could dislodge memories. Weaving back and forth with her long knife, Ingva slashed at them, making shallow and playful cuts in their gray skin. Despite their continued frantic protestations, she murdered a 6th Gola. Only 2 remained. Waff 1 and his last identical sibling, Waff 7, could feel hidden thoughts and experiences boiling through the turmoil in their minds like regurgitated food. Waff 1 watched the agony around him, saw the corpses of his brothers. The memories were locked away, but not by the veils of time. Rather, he suspected the old masters had implanted some sort of internal security system.
"Oh, just kill them all," Helica said. "We have wasted your time today, Navigator."
"Wait," Edric said through a speaker in his tank. "Allow this to play out."
The tension and the panic in the 2 remaining Golas had reached a peak. By now, the pressure of the crisis should have caused a critical meltdown. Acting on her own, without looking at Uxtal or the Matre Superior, Ingva drew the slaughtering knife across the belly of Waff 7 and eviscerated him. Blood and entrails spilled out, and he doubled over, screaming, trying to hold his intestines inside. He took a long time dying, and his moans filled the room with Uxtal's repeated demands for information as a counterpoint. Now, the Matre Superior herself strode forward, glaring at Uxtal.
This is a tedious failure, little man. You are worthless.
She drew a small, stubby dagger from her waist. Moving up to Waff 1, she pressed the point against his temple.
This is the thinnest point in your skull.
I'd barely need to press at all to shove my blade into your brain. Maybe that will cut loose your memories. The knife's tip drew a drop of dark blood. You have 10 seconds. Waff was giddy with terror, and only distantly aware that both his bowels and his bladder had let loose. Helica began counting down. Numbers like sledgehammers struck his mind.
Numbers. Formulae.
Calculations. Sacred mathematical combinations. Wait! The Matre Superior completed her countdown. The navigator continued to observe. Uxtal himself trembled in terror, as if convinced she would kill him next. Waff suddenly started babbling a steady stream of information that he had never learned from the forced education systems. It flowed out of him like sewage from a burst pipe. Materials, procedures, random quotations from the secret catechism of the Great Belief. He described secret meetings with honored Matres aboard a no-ship, about how the old Tleilaxu had meant to betray the Bene Gesserit, how he and his fellow masters did not trust the oddly changed lost Tleilaxu from the scattering. Lost Tleilaxu such as Uxtal.
Please withdraw your knife, Matre Superior, the navigator said. He has not yet revealed what we need.
Ingva brandished her own blade, apparently anxious to murder the last Gola, as if she had not yet spilled enough blood for one day.
He will.
Uxtal looked at the terrified, miserable Gola. This Waff has just been buried by the mudslide of his past life.
Many lives.
In desperate self-defense, the reawakened master spewed forth what he could. But his memory was imperfect, and he couldn't get it all. Whole segments of knowledge were corrupted, a side effect of the forbidden acceleration process. Give him time to sort through it all, Uxtal said, sounding pathetically relieved. Even with what he has said already, I can see the path to new methods that may yield melange. Helica still pressed her short knife against Waff's head.
Matre Superior! He is too great a resource to waste at this time. We can coax more out of him.
Or torture it out, Ingva suggested.
Uxtal grabbed the sweaty hand of the last Gola. I require this one for my work. Otherwise, there will be delays. Without waiting for an answer, he yanked the weak-kneed Waff away from the macabre scene. Clean this up, Helica demanded of Ingva, who in turn ordered the lab assistants to do it. As Uxtal hurried away with his young charge, he lowered his voice to a threatening whisper.
I lied to save your life. Now give me the rest of the information.
The Golan nearly collapsed.
I remember nothing more. It is all still churning inside me, but I can sense great gaps. Something is wrong.
Uxtal cuffed him.
You had better come up with something good anyway, or both of us are dead.
As human beings, we have trouble functioning in environments in which we feel threatened. The threat becomes the focus of our existence. But safety is one of the great illusions of the universe. Nowhere is it truly safe. Bene Gesserit, Study on the Human Condition, BG Archives, Section VZ908. The handlers welcomed their visitors as friends and allies, wanting to hear more about their struggles with the honored Matres. The group sat on the roof of one of the wide cylindrical towers. On a flat stone in the middle of the plank floor, a brazier sent a warm, comforting glow into the night.
"We knew you would be coming," Orak Tho said. "When you dropped the no-field to launch your small ships, we detected your great vessel above us. We are aware that you have also sent scavenging teams to uninhabited portions of our world. We were waiting for you to come visit us directly."
Squatting next to Shiana, Miles Tegg was surprised, since these people seemed to have very little technology.
"It would take sensitive detectors to spot us."
"Long ago, we developed a means to sense the ships flown by honored Matres for our own protection. Because those women think they are infallible, it is easier to detect them."
"Hubris is their principal weakness," Thufir Hawat said.
Green eyes flashed from the bandit mask of dark skin.
"They have many weaknesses.
We've had to learn how to exploit them." They shared a meal of nuts, fruit, smoked fish, and medallions of a spiced dark meat that apparently came from an arboreal rodent. The rabbi was more relaxed than Shiana had ever seen him, though he seemed worried about the origin of the food. She could tell that the old man had already made up his mind. He wanted his people to settle here, if the handlers would have them. While they sat together on the open rooftop, listening to the buzz of night insects and watching the swoop of dark birds, Shiana felt very isolated. According to scan reports, the handlers' population was relatively large, with mines and industries in other parts of the world. They had apparently developed a quiet and peaceful civilization.
"We assume your people originated in the scattering, long ago after the